From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa about the growing Latinx community and what needs to improve to help them thrive. Then we'll learn how UWM's Roberto Hernandez Center is celebrating the history of those who fought for equity at the university.
The idea was to provide bilingual services to the community, to have a satellite office in the community, and to really recruit with intention and increase the number of Latinos that were attending UWM.
Plus, we'll learn how teaching is changing as a result of the coronavirus pandemic.
We need to make teaching a more attractive job in a really broad way, and that's something that's frankly gotten probably less likely during the pandemic and not more likely.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with this. The Hispanic community in Milwaukee County makes up about 40% of the entire state's Latinx population. Milwaukee Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa represents a large portion of that group. She served Milwaukee's 8th State Assembly District for more than 10 years before being elected to the Milwaukee Common Council. WUWM's Marty Michelson spoke to Zamarripa about the growing Latinx population in our area and their contributions to the community.
Well, certainly in our population growth, I'm excited to know that we're, you know, growing across the great state of Wisconsin and have become the largest minority group in the state. I think that in and of itself is very promising. Other things that we've made strides in, I think immigrants across the board have always believed have a tremendous entrepreneurial spirit, and that is no different in our Latino community, with many Latino, in particular Latino immigrants, being tremendous entrepreneurs. And so I think we bring a lot to the small business community and the business community in general.
And what areas need improvement for Milwaukee's Latino community?
For all of my adult life has been to increase the Latino vote and increase Latino voter civic engagement in my community here in Milwaukee in particular, where I was born and raised. And yet we continue to see these very low voter turnout numbers. And it concerns me greatly because I see us not gaining the political influence in our local and state governments in the way that I believe that we should, considering we are, in many aspects, the future of the great state of Wisconsin. So that concerns me a great deal, that I'm not seeing our great numbers translating into political influence and power, really, in the way that I think it should.
Well, now, next year's governor's race is coming into focus. What would you like to see from the gubernatorial candidates as far as issues important to Latinos?
I'm very supportive of Governor Eva's reelection. He has already taken a historic step, an unprecedented step, in standing with immigrant Wisconsinites by supporting things like tuition equity for Wisconsin Dreamers, like driver's licenses for undocumented Wisconsinites. These are unprecedented moves for a governor of Wisconsin to make, and yet he has done them in a real concrete way, putting them in multiple budgets that he introduced. He made sure to introduce those pieces of policy in two budget proposals, and I'll be forever grateful. But now what we need is a legislature to follow Tony's lead.
You mentioned your support for Governor Evers, but is there anything he could do differently?
This isn't a fight against just Governor Evers. One thing I've noticed around a variety of different governmental entities, whether it's at City Hall where I work, or the state of Wisconsin, or even county government, I have seen us falter when it comes to bilingualism, English, Spanish in particular, considering the numbers. We are, again, Latino Wisconsinites are the fastest growing minority group. And yet I haven't seen government at any level here in Wisconsin really truly work to be bilingual and bicultural for their Latino Spanish preference constituency. And that's problematic. I remember when we first started to come under the pandemic and the governor put out a safer at home order, it took too long to get the information translated into Spanish. I remember I had a volunteer help me translate it just on my own from my office because it just was taking too long to get it in the way that we should have gotten it from governmental entities. And that's not just something on Governor Evers' shoulders. As I said, I've witnessed it at the city level in Milwaukee. I've seen it coming out of the county as well. We have to have an emphasis in particular on bilingualism, English-Spanish, and biculturalism, considering the huge growth of our Latino population here in Wisconsin.
And finally, what does it mean for Latinos in Milwaukee to see Latinos in leadership positions?
I have always believed that seeing Latinos in leadership positions helps to inspire other Latinos, in particular young Latinos and Latinas or Latinx youth. I believe that we can help to inspire that next generation. It's one of the reasons why I threw my hat in to run for office myself. I was volunteering and working for candidates that I believe strongly in, that I believe would represent the community. But I didn't see Latinas holding elected office, many Latinas anyway, holding elected office at that time, and decided to throw my hat in because I had high hopes that this would help to inspire that increased Latino voter turnout, that increased Latino civic engagement that I have always longed for since I was a young adult. And so I think it's important to see Latinos still in leadership roles, and we are seeing that. We have Latinos on both sides of the aisle in the state legislature, in the assembly. We have yet to elect ever a Latino or Latinx state senator in the state, and that voice is sorely missed.
Alderwoman Jocasta Zamarripa represents the city's 8th district. She spoke to WUWM's Marty Michelson as a part of our Hispanic Heritage Month conversations. You can find more of them at wuwm.com/Hispanic Heritage. In 1970, only 12 Latinx students attended UW-Milwaukee. Latinx activists felt low enrollment was due to the lack of support by the university. To fight for change, Roberto Hernandez, along with the support of community members, religious organizations, and fellow activists, staged a sit-in at the chancellor's office. Their efforts proved fruitful. Later that fall, UWM opened its Spanish-speaking outreach institute to support the needs of Latinx students. Today, the institute is known as the Roberto Hernandez Center. They have been collecting the histories of local advocates, leaders, students, staff, and faculty to build the Latinx Activism Oral History Community Project. Alberto Maldonado is the executive director of the Roberto Hernandez Center. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the legacy of Hernandez and the power of this project.
Thank you so much, Alberto, for joining me here on Lake Effect. Let's just start with a brief history. Who is Roberto Hernandez, and what is his legacy at the university?
Roberto Hernandez is one of those 12 students that attended UWM, 12 Latino students attending UWM in the year 1970. What I know about Roberto is that he was a natural-born leader, someone who was very involved in community activism and school, and really was just a natural leader that really took it upon himself and others in the community, along with other students at that time, to really advance the needs of the community, right? And at that time, what we know now as the Roberto Hernandez Center did not exist. So he advocated and really rallied behind this idea that a center needed to be created for the university to really be intentional about recruiting, retaining, and graduating other fellow Latinos here at UWM. Roberto then becomes, sort of one of those champions at the time. And it's not until the mid-90s that the center, after originally being named the Spanish-Speaking Outreach Institute, is then goes through changes, right? And we sort of have this reimagining of the center. And we thought, what a best way to honor the legacy of Roberto, who was that individual that, along with community and other students at that time, really led the creation of what is known now as the Roberto Hernández Centers. I follow in the footsteps of someone like Roberto and many others.
What built up to the activism that happened that Roberto and other community members were a part of?
If we look back in history, there were lots of things happening in sort of that window of time between the late 60s and the early 70s. And so there was a lot of movements that were out there and pro of migrant workers, fair housing here in Milwaukee, right? During that time, this became sort of a point of contention, right? Or a point of interest for those students and for community to say, hey, here's an institution, but there's not many of us attending. Why that is, right? And learning the lack of efforts in the part of the university, it's when students and community begin to rally behind this idea that something needed to be done, some, you know, conversations needed to be had with the School of Education, with the Chancellor's Office, with different offices on campus. And so in light of failed efforts to engage in those conversations, you know, Roberto, you know, really rallied behind this idea of just take the conversation to administration and see what happens. That led to what's known by the Chapman Hall takeover. Students went into the chancellor's office and sat there until they were able to have a conversation with the administration. And so in a very peaceful way, right? There was nothing that led to any altercations, anything like that. Ended up with 6 students being arrested as part of the demonstration that went over 3 days. It was a 3 days of protest and advocacy. But ultimately, Chancellor Clatchy, who was the chancellor at the time, sat down and heard the demands and understood the demands and agreed that something needed to be done. So it was a huge victory on the part of Roberto, Jesus Salas, Ernesto Chacon, women, elderly, you know, the faith-based community also here in the Latino community and everyone, right? Because it took an effort of the entire community to really support what it was being demanded and what the idea was to really provide bilingual services to the community, to have a satellite office in the community to really provide intentional services and to really recruit with intention and increase the number of Latinos that were attending UWM at the time. And so that was August 27th when that event happened. It wasn't not until October 31st, I understand, that the center opened its doors for the first time.
I do want to ask about the digital archive now that you all are releasing or showing. Could you talk a bit about it? How is Roberto Hernandez's legacy being remembered through this archive?
Last year, when the center turned 50, in the midst of COVID and through a virtual way, and it was at the time where we decided that the root of all commemorations and celebration was to understand the history and understand what histories and what stories hadn't been told yet, because we had good stories and a good handle on what had taken place towards the creation of the center. We felt that there was a need to reach out even further and find out who were the other protagonists, who were the other people involved, who were the people impacted positively by the creation of the center, who are the sons and daughters of those who sat in the chancellor's office, and also include the voices of women, children, elders, identifying, a lot of the people who were in those black and white photographs that we didn't know who they were because, 50 years had gone by and we, we might have lost some of those individuals who could really point at some of those names and identify that. So in a very organic way, we said, this is why we're celebrating 50, and this is where we want to start. And it's really taking a deep dive into the history and begin to create an inventory of people that we wanted, that we were curious to hear from, that are still in our community. And we began conducting a series of interviews, virtual interviews, and really archiving all these stories from students who were here not only back in 1970, but those who were here in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, and begin to hear from them as to what sort of impact Roberto Hernandez Center and the legacy has meant to them, and what was their contributions as students, as alums, as elders that live in our community today. And so that's what we want to present to the community, is the sort of the culmination of a lot of facts and conversation gathering, and bringing those, like I said before, those protagonists and those individuals who for some reason, right, we couldn't find in a book, or we couldn't, you know, really identify it on a picture, and give them life and give them for perpetuity, right? they're going to live now in the archives that are now going to be here at UWM. And we want to share that with the community, because UWM's history is Milwaukee's history, and it's Wisconsin's history. And what that's what we want young people and folks from all races and from all corners of our city to understand, that this is what happened, and this is, you know, where we are now, and these are the lives that we have been impacting by something that perhaps was deemed as small, and yeah, it had some notoriety at the time, but it has been lost throughout the years, and we want to really preserve that, because that's the foundation of where I stand now, is in the, and what Roberto dreamed about, what the community dreamed about, it's what I hope to continue as a legacy.
How is the university sharing these interviews that the whole team had conducted?
So as part of Latinx Heritage Month, it is our intention to host an event to invite community to join us for a program that we will have, where we would really showcase where this information lives. We would showcase images, artifacts. We will have some entertainment by former staff of the center from the 1980s. We really want to, like I said before, provide an opportunity for community to know who are those gems that still live in our community, who were played a pivotal role in the creation of the center. And they can hear directly from them, you know, as storytellers and as people who have done great things throughout their, you know, trajectory in the community and also here at UWM.
And with history and with continuing the legacies of community work, you have to know where they started so you know where to keep going and move forward. So Hernandez, the members of the Council of Latin American Education, and like you said earlier, along with community members from all walks of life within the Latinx community in Milwaukee, fought to address significant gaps in educational opportunities for Latinx students in Milwaukee in higher education. As the director of the center and as administrator of the university, how is the university continuing to uphold these foundational values of equity that the activists like Hernandez have fought for?
We're at the place in our history where that is front and center for our university. I am very fortunate to work in a division for diversity and inclusion and equity that really fosters that, you know, day in and day out. I'm also the co-lead for the Chancellor's Committee for Hispanic Serving Initiatives. And so, you know, it is the Chancellor and the administration who are saying, you know, we want to increase the number of Latinx students on campus. We want to support, you know, anything that would help students stay and graduate from the university, and also recruit them, right? So it's this idea that, you know, you look back 50 years ago and there were only 12 Latinx students on campus. Today, there's over 2,600. With those numbers comes greater responsibility, and not just for the Latinx community, but for all students of color, right? Indigenous students, Black students, Southeast Asian students, and many other, identity groups and affinity groups on campus, our military, our single parents, our LGBTQ students. And so I feel very, very proud of the direction in which our institution has moved and the stance that it has taken to really support, you know, our students of color and also to really talk openly about anti-racist practices and really infuse, you know, those practices that are going to really create inclusivity and equity. I think there's much that needs to be done. I don't think I'm speaking from a place of everything is peachy and perfect. There's lots of room to cover, and we need to bring as many allies and folks into this conversation because our students need it, our community needs it, and Milwaukee needs it.
Alberto Maldonado is the executive director of the Roberto Hernandez Center. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. You can learn more about Roberto Hernandez and the Latinx Activism Oral History Community Project at wuwm.com. Coming up in about 12 minutes in honor of LGBTQ History Month, we'll learn about some of the state's early gay history. But first, we look into how teaching is changing as a result of the pandemic. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic swiftly changed and shifted nearly every aspect of education. As lessons moved from classrooms to computer screens, students, parents, and teachers had to adjust. The move to virtual schooling also highlighted inequities of access to resources, such as reliable internet, support at home, and the means to attend school virtually. But it perhaps was the most challenging for teachers, who faced an increasing and even overwhelming amount of responsibility. Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University's Law School, and he's reported about various education issues over the course of two decades. He joins me now to share how teaching is changing as a result of the pandemic.
I think the key word to focus on is stress. It's a highly stressed occupation. I bet just about every teacher I've heard of or that you've heard of would tell you they really have a lot of stress these days. And it's stress related to their own health, stress related to being in the classroom and health issues, stress related to the demands wholly beyond the pandemic to get kids to move forward, stress related to resources. And these days, it's highly pertinent in so many communities, stress related to the politics and polarization of the issues around teaching and education. So stress is a key word, and there's no question it's taking a toll on a lot of educators at all levels.
Before the pandemic, I feel like we were moving towards adopting tougher academic standards. And of course, standardized testing is always heavily weighed and not necessarily performance in other aspects. Do you think we didn't really move those expectations for students and teachers during the pandemic and now trying to come out of it, that we're still holding ourselves to a certain standard that existed before this major change?
Well, and to some degree, I'd say I hope so, in that it's still super important for kids to learn to read, to do math, to understand the world, to learn the skills to deal with other people and to solve problems and to think. So nothing's changed as far as what's needed to move ahead and open doors in life, which is the ultimate goal of education. So we should have high standards. That said, you can't expect the same things in the weird circumstances that have existed now since March of 2020. The state test scores from the spring of 2021 will be coming out soon. And it's for me, as someone who's going to write about them, it's a pretty challenging question as how much weight to put on them because the circumstances are so weird. You can't quite say, I expect the same thing to happen in that school year from spring 2020 to spring 2021 as normal, because it wasn't normal. On the other hand, how kids are doing, and I do think test scores overall provide a pretty good handle on it, far from perfect, but pretty good, to get a look at where kids are academically is going to be important. So I do intend to pay attention to the scores, but I hope it's in that broader context of what do we, and I mean the really broad we, need to do to get kids on track in life, and especially those who historically are from situations where not so many kids are on track.
Well, one thing virtual learning and the pandemic highlighted was accessibility for various students and families. And, you know, is there reliable internet at home? Do they have a computer at home? You know, the MPS-wide effort to give out Chromebooks for students to make sure they could be connected. Is that one of the positives you see in that perhaps going forward, these other supplemental resources will be made available so that there is more access for students, no matter where they come from?
I really don't know, and I'm concerned about that. The very first week, I think it was, of the pandemic, I wrote a column saying, okay, virtual ed, now it's your time to shine or fall on your face. And I don't think overall the answer was that it was shining. People, teachers, everyone up and down the education framework and parents and kids deserve an enormous amount of credit for flexibility, adaptability, for making the best efforts. But was it good in the sense of moving kids forward? I doubt it. Have lessons been learned about how to connect with kids? I kind of doubt it. I think in some places, I don't know, 30 or 40 years, there's always been talk that technology is really going to change the way of making education have impact and getting kids to feel bought into their future and so on. I don't know if we really found that here, especially around Milwaukee. I don't know if we found it. I think there's some other places elsewhere that frankly were more creative and more innovative. But overall, I don't think very many people would say, yeah, using Chromebooks is better than teaching in person. It just hasn't happened that way.
Right. Along those lines, do you also think there's a big move to, quote, catch up both students and school systems overall? You know, there's the whole question of, like, all the lost learning time, right, in this adjustment period and in the time it took to get these systems up and running. Do you think that's even a feasible thing to do, to catch up?
Well, it's possible. Is it easy? No. And is doing it by, you know, some great order from above, you know, everyone will get back on track and some high pressured way of doing it. I don't think that's going to work. Do kids need more support now and will they benefit from it? Mentoring, tutoring, just dealing with all the, I mean, I think the sensitivity to social and emotional needs of kids, mental health needs, just feeling connected is very high now. Is it going to happen in a really effective, broad scale way? I hope so, but I don't know. I don't see big systems emerging to do this. And like so many things, unfortunately, I suspect the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, that those who have the best resources, and not even economically necessarily, those are in the best position to move forward, whether it's home support, school districts with better resources, better systems of networking with kids, those are the ones who are going to do the best. And those who are kind of on the left outside are going to be on the left outside.
With this growing need to fill when it comes to support and obviously more teachers, what is the landscape of teachers coming out of universities and coming into the classroom? You know, is there enough to fill the need? Is there the same enthusiasm and energy for people getting into teaching, seeing all these challenges?
I'd go back to that word stress again. In this case, not stress on individuals, but stress on the system, the so-called teacher pipeline, getting people trained and ready to go into classrooms and then retaining them there, having them keep the jobs. This is a huge subject. It was a huge subject before the pandemic. It's probably worse now, although it doesn't appear that there was the flood of teachers quitting at the end of last year that some expected. Nonetheless, Wisconsin Policy Forum did a study recently. Others have done studies. The number of people going through college level training to become teachers is inadequate to the number of teacher openings. School districts of all kinds, city or suburban, rural, private, public, you name it, I think are struggling to fill teaching jobs more so than they did in the past. They're pirating from each other more so than in the past, especially right in the weeks. This happened in a big way in August, but as I know, the districts were stealing teachers from each other within the public school systems, and not just public and private. That happened too. This is maybe premature to say, but the harder it gets to fill jobs, the less picky you are about finding someone, which certainly raises some questions about whether we're getting the best and the brightest in the classrooms, because it's not the most attractive job ever. If you're looking for pay, if you're looking for benefits, if you're looking for job satisfaction, we need to make teaching a more attractive job in a really broad way. And that's something that's frankly gotten probably less likely during the pandemic and not more likely.
Well, and along those lines, and something the Wisconsin Policy Forum also studied was the increasing recognition of the need for more diversity in teaching ranks as well.
Certainly, yes. And that's tough too. There's an increasing number of studies. I just saw one in the last couple hours from Brookings about the impact of more diverse staffs, of students seeing people who look like me in front of them. There's a lot of recognition of this, but it's not easy to fix. There's some really noble, good efforts out there, but it's not easy in the broad picture.
When it comes to what teachers and students have been through throughout the pandemic and coming out of it, what do you see as some changes or shifts in operation that are here to stay?
I think Chromebooks will be used more, and there will be more offerings of outside traditional classroom settings. I'll be very curious to see over the next couple years, starting with the data for this year, which will be coming out soon, whether there's an increase in virtual school enrollment or learning at home environments for kids, homeschooling. Will the creativity of saying there are some cool things to do using the internet or using computers? I hope so, but I'm not so sure. One thing that might come out, and I hope so, is an understanding that we had things better than we thought before the pandemic, that having warm relationships within a classroom, kids with their teachers, kids with each other, the chance to do extracurricular activities together and so on, should be embraced and valued and built up. So maybe appreciating what we have may be one of the things that comes out of this, and that might be good.
Alan Borsick is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University's Law School. Coming up, we'll speak with Madison author Dick Wagner about Wisconsin's early gay history. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's LGBTQ History Month, and the national narrative of gay history often involves events that took place on the coast, the most recognizable, of course, being Stonewall. However, according to scholar and activist Dick Wagner, there was a pre-Stonewall liberation for gays and lesbians forming identities and support networks here in Wisconsin. His book, We've Been Here All Along, examines Wisconsin's early gay history from 1895 to 1969. He joined me in 2019 to talk about it and begins by explaining why the early gay history of Wisconsin was worth his in-depth examination.
What's noteworthy to me is that before Stonewall, you had gays and lesbians in Wisconsin figuring out their identities. They were forming networks of support, which basically is the same liberation that starts to occur greatly after Stonewall. And so you have a pre-Stonewall liberation occurring that is hardly known by folks either in the state or even beyond the state's boundaries.
Right. People don't often think about gay history, especially in the Midwest, much less what occurred on the various coasts in the United States.
Right, right. So, you know, the title We've Been Here All Along is a little stab at, you know, like gay history began before Stonewall, and gay history was not all on the East Coast with Stonewall riots in New York, nor all on the West Coast with the early homophile organizations that were founded out there.
And how did Wisconsin's climate fare compared to other states across the U.S.? I mean, in general, places were very homophobic, especially in early history and especially post-World War II. But what was Wisconsin like?
Well, Wisconsin had the whole apparatus of homophobia. It had legal prohibitions. It had police enforcement. It had the courts opining about how horrible the crime of sodomy was. And then after World War II, it had the whole medical apparatus of sickness that was applied. So Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
Right. And with researching this book extensively, you have great primary documents, photos. What challenges did you face when collecting your research, and what sources did you end up going to back and back again?
I came across surprising resources, and learning how to interpret them, knowing the general writing about gay and lesbian history nationwide, gave me sort of frameworks to go look. The book by Alan Burby about coming out under fire had just one footnote about a Truax study in it. That was done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School and a psychiatrist who was at the Truax Army Air Force Base. And so I actually dug out the study, and the study, while it was about endocrine theories of homosexuality, which was not proved by the study, nevertheless took some life histories of the gay men who were in the study. And one of the just sort of astounding things was that they all rejected the sickness description that had been applied for the medical screening of homosexuals out from World War II. And then there was this throwaway line that the researchers listed that four of them were members of a gay organization, and this was in 1945 here in Madison, Wisconsin. So that just sort of blew my mind that when you start tracking from sources that, you know, there's this sort of total resistance to the self-imposed homophobia that they're supposed to internalize.
And I imagine you needed to pay special attention to language, whether it was finding primary documents
right.
that were within gay groups in Madison and beyond, and the nature of your research with researching people during a period where evidence could be used against them. So finding those subtleties. So what did you find that were key instances or words to look out for, or what did you learn to, like, filter through in your mind?
Well, some of the visible folks were Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. In the 1930s, the two of them bought these little Cornish cottages and started to fix them up and run an antique shop and then eventually sort of a Cornish meal operation out of these old homes. And there were lots of descriptions about them, and they talked about the partners. They didn't use a qualifier like business partners, but they also talked about artistic and about young men, even though they were middle-aged in terms of the lifespan of the period. So clearly these code words were being used to describe them. And you also get some other words that are less coded, like fairy or pixies or other things like that, that get applied to men in the pre-World War II period. So if you know what to look for, you can find the stuff.
With the structure of homophobia, the press certainly played a role in that. And I found it fascinating, you know, the power of language, whether that be in suppressing representation of people or recognition, even though most of the time it was negative, from where you start the book with Oscar Wilde's trial being
right.
covered in Wisconsin to beyond. With you as a researcher and a writer, how did you reflect upon use of language throughout all of the research you were doing?
Well, to me, it was interesting to see how people changed sort of positions. In the Vice study of the 1913-14 period, progressive sociologists roundly condemned permitting Vice to be visible or seen in the communities. And then you had progressive sociologists in the 1930s beginning to talk about homosexuality not as a crime, but as a condition of people. And so they were exploring new theories. And the same with the studies right at the end of the war and following is that, you know, they were showing that gay men and lesbians had actually served in the military services, even though the military had tried to screen them out. So the whole question about whether gay men and women could be patriotic or not is whole part of that McCarthy period of the Lavender Scare. And in Wisconsin, there was resistance to that, as well as sort of admittedly hiding as well.
Right. And I did want to touch upon that with Senator Joe McCarthy being of one of Wisconsin's
yep.
you know, big historical figures. You found he was prosecuting gays more than communists, yet that wasn't getting as much attention in the press. You know, we think of McCarthyism, we think of communism being
right.
rooted out
right.
by any means possible.
Right.
So what was this other side to it?
Well, McCarthy, in his own words, was quite against commies and queers. And one of the Republican bosses in the state urged the Republicans nationally to pick up the McCarthy charges because he was having an effect against homosexuals in government. So the whole apparatus, which was focused about trying to rid homosexuals out of government service, comes in with actually the Eisenhower administration. Previously, homosexuals might have been judged as a security risk on an individual basis, but with the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower executive order, it was a whole class of people just by their status that was considered a security risk. So, you know, Wisconsin went through that as well. There were folks at Truax who were sort of bopped out of the military services. But many more nevertheless served and resisted that.
Another thing to touch upon that I feel is important is also along Wisconsin institutions, UW-Wisconsin's treatment of gay students. You know, we here
right.
at Milwaukee's NPR, we're under UW-Milwaukee, which is, of course, part
right.
of the bigger UW system.
Right.
So could you touch upon how the gay students were treated at UW-Wisconsin-Madison in particular when it comes to regards of therapeutic discipline and the 1962 purge? I feel like when people think of our college institutions, this is not touched upon a whole lot.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
The Madison campus initiated a what they called, as you said, therapeutic discipline, where if someone was found out to be homosexual, and it was all men, that they were sent to psychiatrists because they were presumed to be sick and that maybe they could be adjusted or cured. Some of them played along with that because they wanted to get readmitted back into the university. Others simply said, no, I'm not sick. I don't want to go to the psychiatrist. So, but in those cases, they often lost financial support or were denied access to the School of Medicine or the College of Education. Because it wasn't thought those were appropriate roles for homosexuals to fill. There had been some earlier cases arising in Milwaukee at the extension operation, which caused a Regents investigation, which listed a 1,000-page report. And there were concerns then raised over counseling of a potential lesbian student in the Milwaukee system, as well as there was a controversy that arose with the firing of the dean of the extension system over in Milwaukee, who then charged that President Frank of the university and his backers in the Progressive Party were supporting immorality, including homosexual immorality, in that period. And the progressives and socialists in the state joined in the fight against that and beating back that attack.
Is that unique to Wisconsin history compared to other states who had similar things going on with Wisconsin's Progressive Party influence?
Right. This mini Lavender Scare in the 30s did not occur in many places. There was also, it was both a Lavender and Red Scare in the 30s, and there were very few of those around the country. And to align the forces of the Progressive Party and the Socialist out of Milwaukee against that showed that they had moved from where they were in the pre-World War period, where they were all against suppressing vice. And in this case, they were sort of fighting against the sort of Lavender Scare charges that had been raised, in this case by conservative Democrats.
How did you find that people within the university were resilient in finding ways to fight back against what was happening?
Well, the remarkable thing is that you have the predominant narrative from homophobia that homosexuals are criminals or they're sick. And the way to counteract that was to try and get their own voices heard. It's similar to the post-Stonewall coming out experience of where telling your own stories is a way to contradict the assumptions, wrongheaded assumptions about gays and lesbians. And so by gay people participating in these studies by UW academics in the 30s and the 40s and into the 50s, they were trying to change the narrative by actually describing their own lives as not something quite so odd. And the other interesting thing was that in many of the comments, they would talk about not sex, but about love. And so that was also trying to change the definition, because the also other assumption and narrative was that, you know, homosexuals were all sex fiends, and of course heterosexuals were not sex fiends.
Right. I also want to bring attention to, you highlight a lot of people in your book. A couple on the front, Charlotte Partridge and Miriam Fink, have Milwaukee roots out here and founded Milwaukee's Layton School of the Arts. Could you describe to listeners a little bit of their story?
Sure. They met at Milwaukee Downer College, and female colleges were terrible breeding grounds for these sort of domestic friendships, which was the name for two women who would live together before lesbians became a popular name for that. And so they left their room at the college, which the college had provided them as part of their compensation, and moved off campus. And then they went on to found the Layton School for Arts in the basement of the Layton Galleries. They were very involved with the Work Progress Administration arts programs during the New Deal. And in fact, when Charlotte Partridge, who was more the artist of the group who had been running that, had to step down, her partner, Miriam Frink, stepped in for the while she was there. They were quite remarkable women. They were well known in Milwaukee's civic circles. They were on committees to honor Victor Berger's widow, Meta, who was very well known in the community as well. They built a house in suburban Thiensville, and had a studio up on the north shore of Lake Michigan near Fox Point. And so here you had these two remarkable women leading their partnered life together in the public sphere of Milwaukee. They also encouraged gay artists at the Layton School for the Arts. So they were a remarkable couple.
One thing I noticed going through the book is, of course, the different way that gay men were affected by the goings-ons of the time versus lesbians. What what are your observations on that? And
well,
is it the nature of history and the still yet limited roles women could play?
Yes, it was. Women's roles were circumscribed. And one of the conversations I had with one of the people who had reviewed the book was that women's sexuality was often discounted. And so, you know, men acting out sexually different was thought to be very dangerous, and women's sexuality was hardly noticed in so many ways back in those days. In fact, at one point, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that sort of the old statute against sodomy or crime against nature couldn't be applied to women because there was no male organ involved. Later, the legislature corrected that to change it to sexual perversion, which included both sexes. But again, that was just another example of how female sexuality was given a lesser prominence. One of the other things is that the Dean of Women on the Madison campus at the time of the gay purge in 1962 was a lesbian, and she wasn't interested in purging women students who might have been accused of lesbianism, and in fact, the student discipline files don't show any of those kinds of cases. There were some 50 women who were disciplined for heterosexual violations, and another 50 men who were disciplined for homosexual violations, but no lesbian violations.
What do you think is one of the most valuable lessons readers can take away from learning about Wisconsin's early gay history?
One of it is the agency of gays and lesbians themselves in establishing their lives and in establishing places where they could live and beginning to tell their stories. In other words, and this is the first volume of two volumes, and the second volume tells the remarkable story of how that early impulse for liberation in Wisconsin is fully realized when we become the first state to pass a gay rights law.
Well, Dick Wagner, thank you so much for your extensive work on this book. It certainly offers a lot of great insights. And thank you so much for the time you took to speak with me about it today.
Glad to do it, Audrey.
Dick Wagner is the author of We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History, as well as Coming Out, Moving Forward, Wisconsin's Recent Gay History. You can hear our conversation about that book at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Beck Salgado, Chase Browning, and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Taryn Powell, and Marty Michelson from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, and Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon to find out why Themesville is completely contained within Mequon, yet a separate town, in our latest installment of Bubbler Talk. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, just look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.